And now we're going to move on to Leah Phillips, who whose title is Recontextualizing Myth, Mythopoeic Young Adult Fantasy and Change.
I do want to say that this paper comes from a bit of my PhD research that I haven't really explored yet. So in a lot of ways, I'm asking more questions than I'm giving answers and kind of laying the groundwork for where I'm hoping to go. From its very beginning, myth has appealed to the state of being human. It works to articulate an individual's place within the world while at the same time creating that world. It's about social cohesion. It's about guiding individuals through life stages, a function particularly important for adolescents. In other words, myth is an orientating literature, situates individuals within a culture, and as adolescents are effectively transitioning from one culture to another, myth or mythopoeic literature can and does work to assist this transition. Yet, in order to do so, myth has traditionally spoken to four rather geographically distinct and homogenous groups. So I'm kind of positing myth as functioning within a socially cohesive group, but I'm going to show that kind of in our worlds with technology and online worlds and fandom that those traditional groups kind of struggle to exist. Now, however, it must function globally. It must, in a sense, constitute communities rather than serving the needs of a particular one, a feat achieved in the creation of concomitant online worlds or fandoms. Focused on these and other mythopoeic texts, these online worlds suggest that myth, through the internet, now constitutes communities, communities that exist through the shared experience of a text despite geographical and or cultural differences. For adolescents in particular, this transformation of myth often centers around the hero story. With his journey conveying traditional coming-of-age themes, the hero must complete his quest in order to transcend the next level, so happily ever after. That journey serves as a framework upon which these new communities can be formed. However, conventionally defined by famous white men as being about famous white men, this journey is often his story. Through the figure of the hero, Gilgamesh, Odysseus, Beowulf, Sir Gawain and his Green Knight, Aragorn, son of Arathorn, Luke Skywalker and Prince Charming, the same story is repeatedly told, the story of his domination over some evil foe. In a daring adventure with right on his side, this hero is pitted against monsters, usually winning the hands of a princess for his troubles. Inextricably bound to that figure of the hero, this journey, while appearing adventuresome, is often at its core always the same. It's the story of his superiority and his success. Within that frame, there is then no space for the female hero. As not the hero, she exists as his opposite, the passive damsel in distress, or so it would seem. Within mythopoeic young adult literature, this insistence upon the hero's maleness is, however, no longer required. These texts now feature female heroes, as is the case with Tamara Pierce's Alana the First Adventure and her Wolfspeaker. These two texts, while participating in the conversation of myth, shift the context of that old story, bringing it firmly into the present. Each text, working as a tortall legend, is the story of heroes. An idea made her jaw drop. If she's a legend and a hero, then anyone could be a hero. Even when those heroes turn up in the most unlikely of places. Wonderful. You're on a hero's quest to get rid of bullies. While the hero, or sheroes, as they're dubbed on an online discussion board Pierce co-founded, may take a different shape or earn their title fighting bullies, she, nor he, is still a hero as long as actions merit the title. She's a hero. She's proved it over and over. So while this change from a male hero to a female hero might appear to be quite superficial, the journey is, after all, still completed. It isn't without consequence to this mythic tradition. Not only does the inclusion of the female hero introduce an element of bodily instability, not previously present within the tradition, but it also opens a space for resituating myth. In terms of bodily instability, where the traditional hero is constructed as a young man and is usually in peak health and form, like Prince Charming is kind of that ideal figure. The female hero undergoes bodily change. It's an integral part of her hero's journey. Through the introduction of the female hero and of these concomitant online worlds, the horizons of myth expand. Thus, in order to explore the relationship between this rearticulation of myth through female heroes and its resituation within these online worlds. I'll briefly look at two key moments of change before shifting to an exploration of myth's resituation within the changing scope of technology. So first, shapeshifting destabilizing that mythic form. With the narration of Dane shapeshifting in Pierce's Wolfspeaker, the body that ought to be stable is constructed as unstable. She looked at her hands and feet. They were still human, but a fine gray fuzz covered them, and the tips of her nails were black claws. Initially, this narration works to establish change by defining what does not change, the human that somehow exists before, and yet also after change has occurred. By remaining human, despite being covered and despite black claws, despite change, the hands and feet appeal to a stable core, a core of human expressed on the body that has not changed. Appealing to the core of the traditional journey, narration establishes a tension between the results of change and that which has not changed. Thus, this reading works to disrupt those oppositions. Beginning with, they were still human, but, which works to question the possibility of any stability, bodily or otherwise. In that, narration introduces the possibility that neither complete change nor complete stability has occurred, and in doing so, both are called into question. Change, as an act, thus works to produce the results of that act as existing on or as a continuum, effectively uniting the oppositions. In other words, while the hands and feet are claimed to be still human, a fine grey fuzz and black claws are not. And though these things are now connected to that which is human, they themselves are not human and worry to jeopardize the humanness of what they touch. The stability of the human is worried, just as the lingering human works to worry the completeness of change. Further, change is narrated as fuzz covered them, her hands and feet, locating the results of that change on top of the body. The fuzz is covering a body that has perhaps been obscured rather than changed utterly, a reading developed by the location on the outer extremities of this change. Change is constructed not only as working to disguise or mask the body, but also as a layering. One thing does not necessarily replace another, but is instead laid atop it. However, while the tips of her nails were now black claws, does appear to appeal to a more complete change, thus potentially disrupting the above reading, it too can be read as a layering, in that only the tips have made this shift. Thus, there are levels to this change, a blurring through covering or a partial, though complete in itself, shift with the tips. And secondly, transition into womanhood, normalizing change. Disguised as a boy while training to become a knight, the narration of Alana's transition in Pierce's first test begins with her seeking the help of a healing woman as she was bleeding from the secret place between her legs. Masquerading as a boy, Alana seeks the help of this healing woman because in this peculiarly female moment, she does not understand her changing body. Her bleeding has no meaning. The change that this bleeding heralds has no meaning. In this time of crisis, the physicality of the body is not enough. Alana lacks the ability to read, to understand its signification. Thus, this narration of change is not only about transitioning from childhood into womanhood, but also about attempting to normalize that transition. In this instance, then, it is a woman who provides signification. "You poor child," she chuckled. "Did no one ever tell you of a woman's monthly cycle, the fertility cycle?" Initially, this narration works through language to differentiate Alana, the child, from the woman, the she, simultaneously constructing a tension between the two, a tension that is wrapped up in the knowing of this cycle. She is narrated as knowing, while the child is not. Despite Alana being a woman through the physicality of the cycle, she is also a child owing to the lack of its telling. Thus, Alana is constructed as occupying the space between the two. She's not simply child nor woman. Alana is poor child, and this is the transition through the telling. It's the narration of through changes of the telling through transition. There's too many ions there. Working to situate the body within a dialogue and to construct it as known through that dialogue, this telling facilitates through the intermediary poor child the change from child to woman. Until told, the child does not know the body. She cannot become a woman. However, while constructed as unknowing in one respect, this child is constructed as knowing in another. Alana is aware of that bleeding. Thus, bleeding at once exists and yet does not. So narration constructs a division between the physical occurrence and the story, the telling of it. Without it, the child remains poor, outside the dialogue, and unable to become a woman. For it is the telling that makes possible the transition into knowledge. That's what this is. It's normal. Dane's shapeshifting and Alana's transition into womanhood both work to show the traditional, perceived as stable body as changeable. The form required of the male hero that was, is essential to traditional conceptions of the hero journey is altered and obscured. Through exploring the oppositions between stability and change and woman and child, the tension between those oppositions is collapsed, as the changing body does not remain a clearly definable part of either side of opposition. Thus, with the obviousness of the body blurred and unsuitable for concrete representation, narration works in those blanks to rearticulate that body, to construct it as it once existing in states of change and as woman or child. However, while these narrations work to introduce change within that mythic tradition, the resultant multiplicities do not simply remain there. For the various fandoms constructed in relation to these texts continue these negotiations of change. Thus, I will conclude by briefly looking to those online worlds as perhaps the newest place of myth. Online worlds, myth's new frontier. The American academic Henry Jenkins argues that we now live in a convergence culture, a culture in which content no longer remains within a single platform, and within which there is so much available information that we must filter out what we seek and receive. In one sense, he's describing the cultural phenomenon in which books become films whose locations become holiday destinations, as well as the transition that the printed book has undergone in order to now also exist as an e-text, not to mention the explosion of websites and other online content. More so than ever, the texts that we come in contact with lack definable boundaries. However, this cultural shift is not limited to texts or technologies, as Jenkins argues that it has also altered our cultural logic. We have shifted from a passive media spectatorship into a participatory culture. Not only do we choose the content we read, the platform that we read it on, and the providers that we read it from, in ways unimaginable to myth's traditional communities, but we also actively create content. This particular interaction is most certainly evident in fandom, the diverse subcultures that coalesce around the above and similar texts. These fan spaces function as communities in which adolescents especially can converge around a shared text, simultaneously creating additional content and community bonds. While fandom comprises a myriad of activities, writing fanfic, participating in role-playing games, even attending real-world conferences, it's the online element that seems the most pivotal to this construction. And in one sense, that has to do with the internet's underlying hypertextual structure. This structure echoes the oral nature of the traditional story, as Steffi discussed this morning, while shifting that original form into a suitable shape for the present day. So where you had the print text, it was very stable, very singular. In moving to these online worlds into hypertext, you can follow links, you can go to additional content. So in a way, even just reading the internet, you work to create your own story. In short, we may not be geographically close enough to share the same oral experience of the story, but we do, for the most part, have smartphones. Further, in occurring predominantly online, fandom offers a certain amount of anonymity to its participants. There is a constructed nature to the online presence of the fan, often with only tenuous links to its real-world creator. And it's precisely this constructedness that seems to be at stake. Not only do fans construct themselves, but they also construct their fan communities. The internet affords participants the scope to create with a perceived lack of real-world consequence. Rather than passive consumers, fandom's participants create their own subversion, at least in the sense that they create their online selves and communities, and the communities within which their selves operate, crossing racial, class, and gender lines in the process. However, while private for the fans, the space is also public, available to anyone with an internet connection. As such, it does become a place requiring negotiation, but one nonetheless of vast potential. In conclusion, mythopoeic young adult literature presents readers with rich inner landscapes, dealing with issues like bodily instability in the form of shape-shifting or transitions into womanhood, while also touching on issues of sexuality, sex, bullies, disability, loss. This literature speaks to the transitioning adolescent. Through often magical secondary worlds, it explores the issues facing adolescents today, proving a rich framework for the creation of concomitant online worlds. And it is these online spaces that adolescents continue negotiating the issues introduced within texts, while also introducing their own. Shipping is in which non-textual relationships are kind of created, is one kind of way that they're morphing these texts. In other words, myth and mythopoeic fantasy is about going beyond the obvious. Through closely reading constructions of the female body in transition and through exploring the online spaces related to these texts, I hope to have taken a closer look at that beyond in order to situate myth, or the changing shape of it, more firmly within the present.